It's very pleasant to be back in this pulpit. It's been two Sundays since I've had the opportunity to stand here. I like it. It's nice. Harry Emerson Fosdick, the minister for whom the great Riverside Church in New York City was built, in his book Great Voices of the Reformation, writes, "Reformation is the climax of a long preparation, as well as the origin of a long consequence. How great an individual may be in the total influence depends on the focusing of strong social trends and preceding drive, how concentrated in one person. When Luther protested the sale of indulgences, he had no previous vision of the consequences, and no one was more surprised than he was when the revolt against Rome proliferated." Well, Anniversary Sunday reminds me that time is flying by, isn't it? The first Anniversary Sunday I spent with you was number 170. Now this is 199. Time goes by. We come and we go, all of us. It's no surprise then that when I read biographies, I turn very quickly to the last page to see how the person died. Is that a bit unusual? Well, I want to see if there's any distilled wisdom in the person's life at the very end, if the biographer has captured it. And to my surprise, I often find there's terror in some people at the end, and resignation in others, and denial in others, and rage in some. And sometimes there's laughter, and sometimes there's fear. A tremendous variety of responses to the end. Sometimes there's a desire for loved ones to gather round the bed. And others, expectation of the road ahead. There's going to be more brightness and more light. The adventure continues. And to others, just a moment of solitude and the wish for a smooth passage. It's no wonder then that the biblical writers and the editors of the Bible took time to create the final death scene of Moses. After all, Moses, in the history and in the hearts of Judaism, was the great chosen instrument of God. Moses was the one who rescued them from slavery. Moses was the one who led them through the wilderness. Moses was the one, they said, who met God face to face and who brought the great laws of heaven down to earth in a manageable form. So how did he die, they said? Was there any final wisdom in him for us, they said? And so the writers gathered all the common wisdom that they knew around them, and they put it into the story of Moses, all the common wisdom so far. And this then is the perceived wisdom of Moses. Listen. "First, you will sense a vast world. You will catch sight of its delights and wonders. You will feel it belongs to you, but you will not reach it or possess it in your lifetime." That's the first bit of wisdom. Now, this isn't about punishment or deprivation. It's a simple truth. We can imagine all things, but we can only touch some things. I cannot visit every street or every woodland clearing in this beautiful country. I cannot see every mountain vista in the world. I cannot grasp fully the deep and profound spiritual perceptions of someone like the Buddha. I can't even plumb the thought and mind of a theologian like Paul Tillich, although I would love to do so. I do not know what my children think, really. I don't know how my wife feels a lot of the time, she tells me. Or the deepest questions of my own heart, I don't really know them. And yet I know that all these belong to me and that they together are my promised land, the full scope of my journey and the source from which all my impulses come. You can sense the vastness, you can discern some of the delights, but you can't possess them all in this lifetime. That's the first bit of Moses' wisdom. Moses died in the land of Moab, says the text, and was buried. The second piece is that our insight and our passion and our vigor belong to us all our days. Moses was old, bright-eyed, and full of energy when he died. So our wit and our wiles and our windows on the world are ours. They came to us, they grew in us, and we possess them all our days. All our days. Although our bodily shape changes and our function changes and the range of our operation changes with time, we possess all those inner things that make us ourselves. Society may prove fickle. We may be the toast of the town one day and yesterday's news the next day, but the inner gifts that mark us will hold us. That's the second bit of wisdom. An old person by presence alone can inspire visionary action without saying one single word. I received an email the other day from an old friend, now retired, living far, far away, telling me briefly what he was doing with his life, not liking the changes very much, but telling me that he was going to stand with a family who'd lost a child years and years ago, and 40 years later they were commemorating that loss. And I wrote back and said to him, "Your very presence in the room will transform the experience for them." Later that day, I saw an old black and white photo of one of my mentors taken in the years when I remembered him, and just seeing him again made my world safer and warmer. To create the great symphony of human lives together, we need the mixture. We need the strident brass and the clanging cymbals and the thundering kettle drums, and we need the sweetness of the strings. These are all tempered by the silence of simply being alive, and the great composer puts all these things into the experience. The insights and the passions and the vigor of your life are going to be there, says the promise. They may change form, but carrying you all the way to the end, they shall. Moses also imparted the promise of an afterglow, a lingering sense of our true greatness in simple lives. The text reads, "The people said, 'Never has there arisen a prophet in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. He was unequaled for all the signs and wonders that the Lord sent him to perform.'" We live in layers. Our forebears are in our souls. Our forebears are literally in our DNA. And our friends are influencing us and being influenced by us around us every day. And the future calls to us through our concern we have for it in our best moments. The best of our parents lives in us. The delight and terrors of our children live in us. Families across the wide world, when we see their smiling faces doing the ordinary things that we do, live in us. Our hearts break for them when we see their lives broken in war and deprivation. Old friends, some of them still gone, some of them still here, bless us every day in memory and in experience. So the rigid separations we tend to make between yesterday and today, between now and tomorrow, between dead and alive, here and departed, are often false and simplistic. All are alive in the mystery beyond our knowing. So, as we pass along and as we pass away, we shall live with the limitations of seeing but not reaching, and it will temper us for a true life right here. And we will retain our best gifts inside us, hoping that they will speak and act with some value, and we will become conduits, bearers of the greatness of past lives, companions of others in our living years, and paragons in some other way to the future. That's the wisdom of Moses distilled through those who loved him. I like that. It feels right to me. Deep enough for meaning, evident enough for some measure of satisfaction. We can rest assured in it. We can rest assured in these things, except for Jericho. There's always Jericho. Did you hear the word Jericho in the reading? Jericho is blocking the vision. Jericho is always there. Now, Jericho is said to be the longest inhabited city in the Middle East. 8,000 before the Common Era, people settled in Jericho. And in the ruins, there is town and destruction, town, destruction, town, destruction, town, destruction, on top of each other, going back thousands of years, and every city built there had a wall. When we're afraid, we build a wall. We consolidate our power by building a wall. We hold people captive to us by building a wall. We build one around our houses so people can't see exactly what we're like with our families. And we build one around our actions so people can't exactly see what we're like within our range. And we build a wall around our ideas and feelings so that people can't exactly see our souls. We can all live behind walls, safely, happily, under the patio lanterns of delusion and arrogance and escapism and denial. And on a clear day, when you look out, if you're behind the walls, all you can see are the bricks of the walls you built. Now, this anniversary Sunday marks the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. Well, it's actually a false number in that the Reformation in Europe began probably at least 200 years before that as a slow burn, a small series of brush fires that were very quickly extinguished by the authorities of the day. Watchtowers were erected everywhere that small fires should not long burn. But in the autumn of 1517, Dr. Martin Luther, Ph.D., a monk and a teacher of great ability, preached a sermon in German, his native tongue. He spoke about the apostasy and the corruption of the ruling elite in the church, his church. And the sermon was so inflammatory, it was printed over 50 times on the newly discovered printing presses of the era. It went everywhere and set brush fires burning everywhere. Of course, the common people said, of course, that's the way it is and has been, and it's not right, they said. Now, Martin Luther had also written 95 theses. We heard about them. And apparently, according to one of my scholar friends, they were not nailed to the cathedral door. It makes for a very evocative story. They were actually glued to the door. It's a little bit less romantic. But that was the way people spoke to each other in public discourse. You would write down a series of conversational things you wanted to talk about, subjects and so on, and you would glue them to the cathedral door, and then people would gather around them and talk about them. So he glued his 95 theses. And among those theses were things like, it's not simply the priests that are the authority. The priesthood belongs to all the people, and we share the responsibility of being servants of Jesus Christ together. And priests ought to be able to marry and to know the joys of family life. Luther himself married a nun who was spirited out of the nunnery on pain of death and had a very happy life with many children with her over many years. But the big issue that caught the flame was the idea of the sale of indulgences. Indulgences could forgive sin, but it wasn't eternal sin. Only God can forgive that, said the church. It's the sins that we tell you are sins, said the church. We'll tell you what the sin is and tell you what great and terrible shape you're in, and then we'll give you a way to get out of it by you paying us money. A nice system if you can get it. And so, in those days, to become a bishop or to become a cardinal was something which you purchased. And the more money you paid, the higher would be your rank in the system of the church. And so it was the wealthy and the wealthiest who bid on these high positions. And the way they did it was to sell indulgences to the poor people in their communities. And when they got enough money, they could pay for their bishopric or their place as a cardinal, and then they would be ordained into the church. Nice system if you can do it. And Luther said, there is something profoundly wrong with this. Actually, he challenged the senior most leader in church and state in Germany, challenged him to his face, and he was excommunicated for it. And excommunicated didn't simply mean that you could stay home and have brunch on a Sunday instead of going to church. It meant that nobody talked to you anymore. Your family was forbidden to speak to you. You were persona non grata, and you could be murdered in the street by anyone who saw you, and that person could go on with impunity. You could be murdered in the street. So for over 20 years, Martin Luther married, had a family, went about his business, writing, teaching, and thinking as a dead man walking. He was not against the whole of the faith. He felt that the church had profound gifts to give to people. He was against the hard crust at the top and the way it was being conducted. This was the wall, you see, the wall of which I spoke. Real life says we can see it, but we can't get there. That's real life. But those behind the wall said, oh, we can get you there, just give us all your money. Indeed, St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, the largest cathedral in the world, was built on the indulgences which led to the Reformation. Real life says your vision, your passion, and your energy are yours, and they will be yours all your life. Those behind the wall said these things belong to the culture, and they will be used any way we please. We will assign you your place and your worth. Real life says that we live among and influence multiple generations. But those behind the wall said, we are but minions to the rulers and the whims of the day. You live, you die, you win, you lose. We, they said, prevail. And in all things, death, life, dreams, sense of self, eternal significance, all of these things in you, they said, are beholden to this wall. Now, these days, recollections of the Reformation cannot simply be about battles between Roman Catholics and Protestants. We don't fight with each other much anymore. Indeed, we may differ, as we do, on several things, but we are cousins and close cousins at that. We coexist, we share, we cooperate. There was much going on back then in that culture when Reformation in the church was rising. It was part of a European explosion towards a new world, towards the realm of science and Renaissance art and customs and global states and the Enlightenment and international exploration and the influx of long-standing foreign wisdom. The human spirit was alive in song suddenly everywhere, and it began to sing its notes against the hard wall of the system that had held it down. Now, these days, we are living in the most rapidly expanding time in human history. This is the fastest we've ever moved, said our Prime Minister the other day, and it is the slowest that we shall ever move again. Isn't that a frightening quote? We are being reprogrammed from the inside out as human beings. As secular values and novel breakthroughs pour through the gates, they're running over us like wild horses, and no one quite knows the outcome. Many people will be trampled. Many people will be left behind. It is still Jericho, however, that stands before us. It is still the walls that must be watched, as it always is. The world of politics has walls. We can be manipulated. We can be touched by international hackers that change our perception of everything. We can be the subject of party intrigue, those who are forced to soak up false news. We know it. The world of economic power has its walls. Challenge them and you lose your job and your income and your status. No one likes a whistleblower. You lose your pension and your dreams. Economic walls will be subjugated to the natural rhythms and the needs of the very web of life. These folk will go out and cut down forests and pollute the rivers and take resources out of the earth again and again and again for gain and for commerce at the expense of those around us and those who will come later, the walls of economic power. The world of social convention has walls too. This fashion is suddenly in. That attitude is suddenly out. This skin color is suddenly in. That accent is out. This age group is in. That generation is out. And our own darkening lives, lived in the shadows of these walls, can depress us as a culture. One of our speakers the other day at the preaching seminar that John Joseph and I attended said that every evening before she goes to bed, she listens to the news on the BBC World Service. Cuddled up in her warm bed in Nova Scotia, she says bad news always sounds better with a British accent. And so she watches the news, and she sees children starving to death, and cities being blown up, and people on the move, and the world turned upside down in tears and in flames. And she says, then I turn out the light, pull the comforter over me, and try to sleep. And I and we, she said, are all suffering from observer guilt. In this culture, we see it too fast, it is too harsh, and we have a feeling that we cannot fix it. Reformation today, then, must take the form of anything that restores the vision of life proposed in the life of Moses, to return to that against the walls we see around us. Here is all there is, and it's enough, says the news. Our inner values and traits are gifts in us that last, says the news. The afterglow of our life is long-lasting and will influence those whom we have never met, those who follow, says the news. Reformation tackles the walls. Now, the implications of this are profound. We can still lose our status and our very lives in this world by standing against the walls. Listen to the news in the evening, read the newspapers, and see who is dying for the things that are profoundly true and essential for all of us. Excommunication is still sudden death in this world. Wall builders will not relinquish their domain easily. But the church that's willing to tackle its own walls, because we all have them, we all have things we won't willingly talk about, we all have social issues we don't want to be involved with. If we're willing to tackle those walls, and thus to become a voice for a deeper humanity and a nobler world, we can still make a difference, and Reformation will be part of us. We still have outlets on every corner and virtual access to every home we meet. Your life journey is significant, though incomplete, says the news. Your vision and vigor are a gift that will never desert you, says the news. You are to be regaled and remembered for yourself and your true place, not by your coercion to the walls of Jericho. Martin Luther said, I cannot and will not recant anything, for to go against conscience is neither right nor safe. Here I stand, I can do no other, so help me God. Amen. He said it to the highest and most powerful authority in his land. He said it face to face. As a church today, we not only worship a living God, we also stand for the vision of God as the Spirit of God reveals itself to us, even in the face of Jericho.